a good deal.
The Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Thursday, January 29th. So thank you all for being here. I just want to recap before we begin that yesterday evening, late in the day, we had our University of Minnesota Region Forum. That was hosted by the Alumni Association. We thank the Alumni Association for doing that. It hadn't been done in many years, and I think those who attended really found it valuable. So for any members who were able to attend, thank you very much. It was a good format. The only thing I would say is that I know, as somebody who's had to participate in those debates and forums, having one-minute answers, I really felt for those candidates because that's pretty tough. So, it was very valuable. And so just to keep people abreast of what's happening on the region front, each of the congressional districts who have candidates up will be meeting over the next couple weeks and bringing forward their recommendations. And then, again, our joint committee will be February 10th. And following that, the joint legislative bodies will meet for the final votes. Okay, so with that, I would call on Commissioner Pogemiller and Ms. Fergus to join us and present the governor's budget.
Afternoon, Madam Chair, members. And as I understand it, there's three things like you'd like to cover in about an hour and a half. The budget recommendations, a part-time pilot year one results analysis, and then the criteria for state grant participation report, which apparently everybody calls the
institutional metrics report.
Institutional metrics report.
So,
starting on the governor's budget, Madam Chair, members, I just start here with two kind of big picture charts just to remind us where we've been and where we are in terms of the first one is the revenue and appropriations per full time equivalent student chart. And this only goes out to 2013. So, in the last year, this is a national number. This are national data. So you will see kind of upticks in the Minnesota appropriations and revenue because of what the legislature did last two years. But this is the picture, and to remind you that Minnesota tends to have smaller appropriations per pupil, per student, but we have more revenue per student. And the bottom line there is we have higher tuition per student in Minnesota. We have a relatively high tuition state across all sectors. The second chart is just general fund appropriations for the higher ed sector, and you have the total, and this is to 2014, so this does show what you've done in the last 2 years. MinSCU and the U are basically equal in their set of appropriations at about almost $600 million a year, so $1.2 billion a year. And the state grant, slight uptick because of the work you've done there. And then the Mayo budget, there's a small piece in the budget for Mayo, and that stays consistent. And then our administrative budget is basically flat. So then going to the governor's recs, Madam Chair and members, it's fairly straightforward. State grant, $25 million increase. University of Minnesota, a $62 million increase. $30 million of that for the medical school, for basically the research function at the medical school, with a small amount of that going to basically rural physician development through some of the programs the U has, and then $32 million for operations at the university, but the governor describes that as 50% of the tuition freeze at the university. MinSCU, as you're all aware now, the governor has not made a recommendation at this point for MinSCU. He's hopeful, I'm trying to use the words he has in his budget document, he's hopeful the current efforts by the trustees and the faculty groups to get charting the future discussions back on track are fruitful. I don't know if this was obvious to everybody, but he literally has $35 or $36 million on the bottom line, which would coincidentally be about the appropriation to MinSCU for half of their tuition increase. Tuition freeze. I believe that number would be $36 million if I'm not Now, I didn't say the governor has that there for Minsky. What I said was, interestingly, there is that money on the bottom
noted.
Line.
Noted. Commissioner Paul Miller.
So when he calls me and says, you didn't quite say that right, you'll defend me. So the $30 million for the university is based on the work of the governor appointed a blue ribbon panel that had university types, healthcare administrator types, and research types, and faculty types on it. And one of their recommendations, you have gotten that report. It was put out a week or two ago.
And commissioner and members, we actually do have it on our agenda on February 12th to hear the whole report.
Okay. And so the only point I wanted to make there is the report has a broad array of recommendations. The governor has chosen as the one he wants to work with this year is a $30 million increase this biennium and $50 million for the next two or three preceding bienniums to basically move the university's preeminence in research up in the NIH rankings. The National Institute of Health is kind of the barometer that all the rating systems use. It's not he's certainly not arguing that that's the only thing that talks about the quality of the university medical school, but in terms of the research function, it is the barometer that is used nationally. And Minnesota currently ranks 30th in NIH research, and the governor would like to move it up into the top decile, which would be in the top 10 or 12 or 13. This amount of money basically would develop 50 new faculty members that would be part of research clusters or research teams, medical discovery teams, and would draw down more, presumably would draw down more NIH research dollars. And again, I want to point out, and this report is pretty clear, everything is not about NIH research dollars. It's much more complex than that. It's simply that that is the national measurement. And so in terms of describing what's going on here, that's why I reference it. But it's much more layered and sophisticated than that. And the university as a whole's research ranking is actually higher than the medical schools. There was an article 2-3 weeks ago in the Tribune, I think, that said that I thought it was in the top 15 or 20 as an entire institution, so beyond just NIH research. And as a part of that $30 million investment in the next biennium, he would like an investment in the physician training programs that benefit underserved and urban communities. And that basically means something called RPAP, which is the Rural Physicians Associate Program. And there's a smaller version, MPAP, which is kind of metro urban areas. And then the kind of the nationally renowned Duluth Rural Scholars Program. The Blue Ribbon Commission and now the governor is suggesting some effort to both firm up those activities, but also maybe increase the capacity of those activities.
Excuse me, Commissioner, just a quick question on that. And members, if you have questions, that is generally how we do things in this committee. I know every committee does it differently, but if you have questions during it, let's get those done. The governor did not propose to do physician debt relief for underserved areas, correct?
That was one of the Blue Ribbon's possibilities. That is not in his budget right now.
Okay.
I can just tell you he's very open to discussions with the legislature on that topic.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Senator Klassen.
Madam Chair, just so we're clear, we do have Senate File 3 that's progressing along, which is a loan forgiveness program, so very similar to what we're talking about.
And I believe that will be heard the same day as we do the report. So.
Correct.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Just as a factoid, the university tuition at the University Medical School is, I think, third in the nation. So it's, as the pattern in Minnesota in general, we're a relatively high tuition state.
Yeah.
So, state grant program then, $25 million increase after all the good work you did in the previous biennium. This is an additional increase. And we've kind of brought it broken down in the budget in two pots. One is basic maintenance, which uses the spending balance because enrollment is down and the federal Pell Grant has been increased. So that frees up money in the program. And so we would like the governor's recommendation is to ensure that living and miscellaneous expense is at the poverty level for 2016. and that's estimated to be about $89.58. And so the bulk of this money, both for the for the spending balance, will go to LME, is the recommendation. I think about $60 million of it. Secondly, to basic maintenance of the system would be to finish the job on getting the tuition and fee maximum cap at the highest public, at a minimum, at the highest public rate in Minnesota, and that is the University of Minnesota's rate at the 4 years, and it's one of the 2 years,
Dakota County
at the 2 years, and so basically this would raise it to those caps, which is 13620 for the university and 5808. Then basically that would take up, to do that, just to basically maintain the system, then you'd put $25 million on top of that. And the purpose of that would then, the governor is suggesting, is to help low-wage working adults and middle-income families. And about $18 million of it would go to lowering the federal assigned responsibility for families, basically bending that down for independent students and for dependent students. It's the independent student group is a group that is basically asked to pay their 50% share of tuition and fees and living expenses, and a family portion, and since they're independent, they don't have a family paying the family portion, so in some sense that can be viewed as kind of a double hit or double taxation for that. And we're talking maybe a 30-year-old independent person who was out in the workforce who has now come back to study. And so we think that, making an effort there would be a really smart thing to do for the workforce. And then a final portion, on the dependent, it's basically trying to put a little more money in to move the income ranges out a little for what we view as lower middle income. And in a perfect world, you'd put a lot of money there and then move the income levels out fairly significantly. But this would basically help your group in the 60 to 80,000 range, your family income, adjusted gross income. So your income's probably 90 or 100,000, but your adjusted gross is somewhere between 50 and 80 probably. Then finally, there's a provision to do what we call a Pell fill-in for underserved students. There are certain criteria where students are not regardless of their income, are not eligible for the federal Pell grant, which can go up to $5,700 roughly. And the two major groups we're interested in there, the governor's interested in, are the Dreamer students who are not eligible under, we have eligibility for the state grant in Minnesota for Dreamer students, but the federal Pell grant is not available to them. The suggestion here is to pay the federal Pell portion. Governor fully understands that that's a federal responsibility. The policy argument is, until the feds do that, those students are at quite a disadvantage, and we're not going to close the attainment gap for that group of students unless we help. That's the policy argument. He doesn't disagree that the Fed should do that, but they don't seem to be doing that in the near short term. The other group that is not eligible for Pell, there's a kind of a changing definition about whether you have got your high school diploma or can benefit from a higher education. And we want to be able to offer around the edges for students who might not totally fit the federal criteria, but are students that we think could be successful in post-secondary, we'd like to do a Pell fill-in for them also. We can get into much more detail with you on the specifics of that. So the bottom line is, under basic maintenance, we would like to get these caps and the LME to a point where students can get to their best-fit institution, whichever that might be. And secondly, that there's some kind of reasonable trade-off between work and study. And we think that tying it to the living miscellaneous expense at the federal poverty level for a nine-month period is a good measure. Most people in higher ed would argue, frankly, that that's too low, that living expenses in Minnesota are actually higher than that. I don't think we disagree with that. I think we're just saying let's at least get to this minimum as something that is kind of the basic way the system runs. Then the next chart just says that $18 million of that $25 would roughly go to these independent students, about $5 million to the middle income, and about $5 million to the unrewarded Pell Grant group. And Madam Chair, just for a brief primer, I was going to ask Ms. Meredith to go through, Ms. Fergus, to go through kind of the basics of the state grant system quickly.
Sure.
So that it puts into context what we mean by maintenance versus enhancements.
Yep. And so we have two questions before we do that. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Pogemiller, could you refresh for, I just kind of missed that piece about the underserved students, that $5.2 million. The fill-in for the unawarded Pell Grants. What, kind of explain that exact category to me again, please.
This is a group, Madam Chair, Senator, this is a group that is eligible for the Minnesota State Grant. And the most obvious group is who you passed legislation for this, for the Dreamers, last session or the session before. So they can get a state grant, but they're not eligible for the federal Pell system under federal law right now. And so, and since that would be the bulk of their financial aid ultimately, they might get maybe $1,000 from the state grant or $500 from the state grant. They're missing the largest chunk. But they're Pell eligible by income. They're just not Pell eligible because at the federal level, immigrant students are not treated as Pell eligible. So this suggestion is to backfill that with state money until they do become federally Pell eligible. The other small group there is a group that may not have its GED or diploma, but that we determine in Minnesota are post-secondary, they have post-secondary capacity. They can benefit from post-secondary education. And so the proposal here is to open that up a little so that we're not stuck with just the federal definition. Because we're headed in kind of a worker shortage in Minnesota, and so if we've got someone who doesn't meet the federal definition, it might be wise for us if they can succeed in post-secondary to try to get them into post-secondary. But that's a much smaller group. And for the Dreamer eligible group, we think that's between 400 and 600 students.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you answered part of my question. I was going to ask, with these financial enhancements, how many students are we actually talking about that we'll be able to extend grants to that previously were unable to?
It's a combination. One is this dramatically increased the grant because of the LME for all 95,000 or 100,000 students. But with the cap change, we would bring in some students who weren't there before, and the middle class change.
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and members, it's about 12,000 additional students would receive state grants.
Senator Klassen?
And that would be in all areas, the middle income families as well? And
Madam Chair, Senator
Ms.
Klassen?
Fergus.
That is the cumulative effect of the governor's proposal. We do have it broken out by each of the changes if you'd like to see that, or if you have a specific change. Was there one you'd like to, one specifically?
Madam Chair, if you do have that information, you could quickly share it with us?
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
Now or just get you
now.
There?
I think now.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay. So particularly which pieces are you most interested in? Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of numbers.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be interested in the middle income families.
Okay.
By income, perhaps.
Yep.
And then Senator Sharon will follow up after with you.
Middle-income families. Madam Chair, Senator, just the change in the middle-income families is about 600 students would receive a grant that were otherwise ineligible. So we're adding about 600 students. It's 569, actually, is the number, because it's a relatively small change. All of the dependent students, though, who currently would have gotten a state grant would also see that increase as well in their grants.
So, Ms. Fergus, to increase by 12,000, and so far we've heard that the middle income is only 600 and the Dreamers, so to speak, is 400, so now we're only at 1,000. Where is the bulk coming from?
Madam Chair, it's the LME change.
For every student.
That is approximately 9,000 students, that change.
Wow. That's great. Thank you. Senator Sharon?
Yes. What can you tell me if as a result of our reviewing of this, we decide that we really don't want to change the increased tuition and fee maxims, how that would impact what you're describing here?
So, Ms. Fergus, if we weren't increasing the caps, how would that change the – and it may not be fair to do that on the spot.
Well, we can tell you how much that costs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The cost is approximately $11 million, and – Madam Chair, we do want to caveat that that assumes there is a tuition freeze at both institutions, at both systems. Of course, the Minsky system is not at the cap, so most of that would go to students at private institutions and the University of Minnesota. The net increase to an individual student for that change is about $310, so that's the dollar amount change. The number of students who are impacted by that change is about 240 would receive a new grant who are otherwise ineligible, but the $310 increase would affect all students at those sectors.
Senator Sharon.
So those provisions here are different, of course, than the living and maintenance, which applies to all students all over the state,
right,
regardless of what educational institution they're in. And I think we had a similar conversation about this issue last year when we left the cap last year. So this is we're doing it again at $600 a student. Did I understand that, close to that?
Yes. And keep in mind, out of the money on the table through both the unexpended balance and the new $25 million, the bulk of it goes into LME, $60 to $65 million of it. Is that the right figure?
60.
Yes,
$60 million of it goes into LME.
But am I correct? Just correct me if I'm wrong, Senator. May I call you Senator? once we lift the cap, then that permanently influences all future decisions that we make about funding here.
In terms of grants.
Yeah.
As does LME increase. As does an LME increase.
But they're very different in terms of who is impacted. The LME affects all students across all campuses, whether private, for-profit, Minsky, or the university. It helps.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator, it is true that currently the tuition fee maximums do largely only impact students at private institutions and the University of Minnesota. However, should Minsky increase its tuition 3%, the tuition fee caps will start affecting students at Dakota County, and then as those tuition and fee increases compound over time, all Minsky students will ultimately be affected.
Senator
Sharon.
Do you believe that the changes in the caps the last time took several years for you to persuade us that we should do that. And so now we're here right away again asking the same question again. And I don't know if you believe this or not, but I'd be interested in your perspective, as I create my own, whether or not refusing to do that particular portion of what you're talking about and still requiring the institutions to maintain freezes on their tuition that encourages solutions that are an efficiency within the system.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely agree, and I think the governor does, that anything we can do to encourage efficiencies within a system that, within systems that raise tuition at three times the inflation rate and three times family incomes for about 5 or 10 years, that would be a good thing. What we're talking about here is recalibrating the basic maintenance, recalibrating the state grant system to what it was before all that happened, and raising the cap and getting LME up, I view as basic maintenance, not as a new policy. As a matter of fact, when this was first designed by the legislature, the tuition cap was higher than the University of Minnesota's, because that group of legislators felt that that's how you create true access across all institutions. All this suggests is that at a minimum, it should be at the highest public, which is the University of Minnesota.
And Commissioner, Senator Sharon, one other option would be to put the kind of pressure you're talking about on it is to assume, okay, so today the highest public institution tuition is blank, so you could cap it at blank, and therefore you wouldn't be sending a signal that the tuition, as it continues to rise, we just have it on autopilot. So that would just, I mean, you may or may not be interested in that either, but that would certainly be another approach. And same with the highest two-year public, you could do it the same way. Okay.
Yep, you go ahead. This is just a short primer on how this thing works so that you have the context. Remember the context.
Madam Chair and members, we did want to just put the state grant program in a little context. Minnesota is nationally recognized for our design for shared responsibility, and several states are looking at adopting the model. And several national organizations, such as WICHE and the State Higher Education Executive Officers, have actually recommended the state grant program design to be a new model that the Pell Grant should be adapted for. We are ninth nationally in grant dollars per student, meaning FTEs. We are seventh nationally in our maximum grants that we allow. The grant does go to one-third of Minnesota resident students who attend Minnesota institutions. It's $178 million per year budgeted. Last year, we had 175,000 applicants. This is about 30,000 fewer than we had at the height of the recession, and we funded just under 100,000 of them. In determining an individual student state grant award, as you know, most of you, this is going to be just a refresher, we add the tuition and fees plus the LME to do the budget, which is that top line. Then what you do is we first allocate to students the first 50% responsibility for those educational expenses. We then bring in the assigned family responsibility, which is that modified EFC or parent contribution and student contribution. Then we allocate the Pell Grant. This would be the part that students in the Dreamer category and what we call the ability to benefit students do not currently receive, and it's a hole that's left open under current law.
On 12, for the middle-income students, we're basically moving this out. The further you move this out, the more you help middle-income students. And then for the independent working students, we're basically lowering the slope of this line.
And then, of course, the last portion to come in is the Minnesota State Grant. This is what we call our technical model, which is the program design. This is what a student actually sees. On their financial aid award letter, across the incomes, they'd first see the Pell Grant awarded by the institution. The state grant would come in next. The remainder of their educational expenses or that cost of attendance would have to be paid by the student or the family, be it through student loans, parent plus loans, working, state work study or federal work study, all of the other forms of aid, the remainder of that light blue and dark blue amount. So this is what the University of Minnesota coverage looks like. And this is what it looks like for a student at Dakota County Technical College. There's still a sizable portion that is left unfunded after state and Pell grants in terms of total educational expenses the students face.
So the point of those two charts, 15, is that light blue portion right here is relative to other students. It's not being covered by the state grant and probably should be. That's why you raise the cap. On this chart, it's to show that for students at Minsky institutions, the 2 years for sure, the lowest income students, kind of up to the $30,000 family adjusted family income, literally get more than tuition and fees. They get tuition fees plus some living expenses. So in the context of free college, you need to keep that in mind. The current system in Minnesota literally does better than free college for low-income students.
The next slide we have for you is just a comparison of our benchmarks. So on the left side of the screen, you see the LME. The current LME in state law for next year is $7,900. The poverty level we anticipate being $8,858. And then if you look at actual data on what students spend in terms of rent, transportation, books, those things, national survey data shows it's actually about $12,600. So we are much lower than what the average student spends. On the right side, what you have are the tuition and fee maximums in law as compared to the red bars, which are the average tuition and fees charged by the various sectors. In terms of the assigned family responsibility, the lines you see on the screen are what we currently have established at how much students should pay by income. If you look at the top line, which is orange, what you can see is that for a student in the $25,000 range, if they're single with no children, we actually expect them to pay about 10% of their income which is $2,500 for a $25,000 income student, which is still quite high for the student who is essentially making $12 an hour. What we'd like to do for that student is, even though at that level they do not receive federal Pell Grants, we'd like to increase the amount of the state grant to at least provide them with some subsidy. But many of those students are not receiving Pell Grants.
We view this in the work-study trade-off. And if you're trying to get retention and completion, allowing people to work less hours can help. And kind of the rule of thumb is, most students work, but the rule of thumb is if you can keep them under 20 hours a week, you create a big benefit for them in terms of their ability to study.
Madam Chair and members, this is just a slide showing how the Pell Grants are allocated across credits from 1 to 15 credits and how the state grant comes in on top of that to create a smoother line for a per-credit transition. This is just simply to kind of, I guess, remind myself that the state grant serves as a complement to Pell, and we always take the two programs in conjunction when we look at how much students receive, which is why filling in for those underserved students who don't get a Pell Grant is important for the office.
And Madam Chair and members, just wrapping up the governor's budget before the other two items in his budget are tuition reciprocity increase of $5.2 million. This is basically because of North Dakota reciprocity. We have a large number of students who go to North Dakota who live in both the suburbs. Is an amazing number from the suburbs who go to North Dakota. It's a lower cost higher ed system than Minnesota's. And because the formula for reciprocity payments is based on the investment made in the home state, and because of the oil boom, North Dakota has raised their tuition, and so that increases our payments. And so that to keep that whole.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, North Dakota has raised their appropriations to institutions, not tuition.
Yes. They've invested more.
Gotcha.
And so that, in the formula, that forces a higher payment on behalf of Minnesota students. Then the last item in the governor's budget is about a $100,000 increase. I think it's $108,000, which is a 1.8% increase in the general fund budget. The governor has done that across all agencies, and I think it's the first time in, I forget exactly, but I think it's 5 or 8 years. And so that's not even inflation, but it's some recognition that agencies are having a hard time through attrition balancing their budgets. For example, we have a small shop, but our full-time equivalent rate is actually down, but it costs us more even with fewer employees. So that's the last item. Madam Chair, that's the end of the budget at this point, and we'll cover the other two items unless you want questions further on this.
Any other comments, questions on the budget before we go to the two reports? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Pogemiller, quick question and help me get up to speed. Reciprocity. So if we're paying North Dakota and they're able to provide a lower tuition to their in-state students. Does reciprocity make sense anymore for that? Help me with the benefits of why we would want to continue that program.
It can work both ways.
Commissioner?
With Wisconsin, there's quite a few students going back and forth. Wisconsin sends us a check. In North Dakota, it's the opposite. We send a lot of students. North Dakota doesn't have many students. And so from a Minnesota perspective, it is less expensive for Minnesota taxpayers for that Minnesota student to get educated if they choose to do it through reciprocity, just on that cold, hard calculation. Because it costs us less than if we had to scale up, I forget the exact number of students, but it seems like about 10,000. If we had to ramp up our ability to handle 10,000 more students in Minnesota, it would cost us more than making a reciprocity payment to North Dakota for them having the students. Now, there's just a report put out by the state demographer in January that says the world might be slightly changing, where it used to be that Minnesota had a big influx of people to Minnesota. We had a net in-migration. There's some evidence now that we are on the verge of having a net out-migration. And I think we just got the report in the last couple of weeks. We want to study this closely to see the impact of that on something like reciprocity. Does it make financial sense for Minnesota to do that, or are we incenting people to go to a different state and never come back? We need to study that more closely.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's part of my point, is not only are we sending a check out, but we've talked about the fact of keeping people in state so that they start their businesses, they keep their careers, raise their families here, and yet we seem to be making it easier for kids to go to a state, and particularly if we've got a competitive disadvantage from a tuition standpoint, we mm-hmm. should be looking at that and seeing if that's right. Now, you know, at least here in the Twin Cities, we share a common border with Wisconsin and probably a lot more even. But yeah, I can tell you from my district and my kids' classes, I'm surprised at the number of students that are going to UND and NDSU.
And I think Senator Pratt, Madam Chair, is on to a point. I think we need to study this closely to see if the world has changed enough where maybe this financial calculation maybe doesn't make as much sense to Minnesota anymore. But I think we don't know. We knew for sure before that even when students went out state to study, they still came back. I think we don't know that answer as well right this moment.
And perhaps, Commissioner Pogemiller, the kids who go to North Dakota and Wisconsin are more likely to come back versus the kids who go a little farther. So all of that should be looked at.
And we have an example here. I think this young lady came to Minnesota to study, and she stayed.
Exactly.
From some Senator, southern state.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Pogemiller. I'm hoping this reciprocity question, I'm so glad that this came up because this is a concern of mine, and I'd like to get more information. Do we have something like, I think they're called interstate transfers, but do we have a report? What I'd like to see is our reciprocity numbers of students to each state and out, and then the cost of tuition at each. And so that'd be really helpful to look at. I want to see kind of like all those numbers and kind of try and analyze those. And I'm wondering if you can tell me, I have often been told, I hope it's not true, but you could probably put an end to this if it's not. Is it true that a student from Wisconsin can actually attend the University of Minnesota for lower cost than a Minnesota student can?
Lower tuition?
Yes.
Madam Chair and Senator, I do not believe that is true anymore. I believe it was true at one time, but I believe the university happily rectified that. But I don't have the exact details or remember when.
Okay.
We'll
thank
ask.
You. So we just thank you, Madam Chair. Just need to make sure that truly is not the case, because that is really a misuse of, I think, our funds here. And then the very last question has to do with Iowa, reciprocity with Iowa. You know, our neighbor to the south, Iowa State University, has a great engineering school. I know students who go there. No reciprocity. So that might get to this question that Senator Pratt was talking about, is let's kind of examine our reciprocity system, and is it really helping Minnesota today? And, you know, is there a reason? I believe we've tried to get reciprocity with Iowa, but they're not interested. So the real question is, why not? So I kind of look forward to that reciprocity report and maybe a in-depth look into that. So thank you.
Very good. And now we've got Senator Miller and then Senator King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Commissioner, you mentioned that at least in the past, it would cost the state more not to have a reciprocity agreement with North Dakota than it would. Can you expand a little bit on that? Does it have to do with the state grant program or just the infrastructure in general?
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, I mean, obviously, if the students came to Minnesota, they potentially could get a state grant. I think the larger factor, though, is the capacity of the Minnesota higher ed system to handle that number of students. And that changes. When we had increasing enrollment, we didn't have the capacity. Now, with declining enrollment, that capacity, that question changes slightly. And I think that's something that, as you examine this, you need to kind of think through what makes most sense. But when we don't have the capacity, it is absolutely less expensive to make a payment to North Dakota than to build the capacity in Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And that's what I was getting at. We've seen some pretty massive enrollment declines, especially in the Minscu system. So I do think it's worth looking at again. I'm not sure that we have the capacity at the University of Minnesota, but I know we do have it currently within the Minscu system. And I'm not sure about the private institutions.
Madam Chair, and an additional complexity there, Senator Miller, is you need to differentiate between two-year capacity and four-year capacity, because on the two-year campuses, there's a lot of relationship to how far away you live from the campus, whether you go there or not. And I think I recall the discussion years ago when reciprocity came in, the kind of northwestern part of the state argued pretty effectively, apparently, that there just were not the options available in their part of the state for the students what they wanted. So they were that part of the state was very supportive of reciprocity.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you are doing that analysis of the demographer's report and sharing all this information, I would be interested to know around the country, are there a lot of these types of reciprocity agreements, and are those being reconsidered? Because I would imagine, well, North Dakota is the exception to everything these days, but, you know, declining enrollment with the improvement of the economy is probably a factor happening in most states. And so the relative relationships, I think, is important. And I would be interested to know what other regions are doing at this time as well.
Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Pogemiller. I was just curious, how much money are we sending to North Dakota, and probably how we relate to other states as well, like Wisconsin. We're getting more back from them.
I think it's $27 million to North Dakota. And I don't remember the exact. Wisconsin sends us money, and they used to net out really nicely. I think Wisconsin's now in the, I'll double check, but I think it's $10 million range, 10 or 12.
I thought it was much higher.
We'll get all that information.
We'll make sure to get all this, and we'll have a hearing on reciprocity. Thank you. Okay, let's keep going.
Between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Oh, the Wisconsin payment's apparently higher than $10 million, so we'll get that for you.
It's about $10 million per year, which means that it nets out between $20 and $25 million. So the total cost to the state of the two programs is about $1 to $2 million net.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Now we have two reports, and both of these reports, members, were reports that we requested last session and are now going to get the results.
Madam Chair and members, the first report that we essentially have completed, which is done, I have it somewhere on my desk here. It will actually be out early next week. The charts and graphs are in communications because apparently I used the wrong colors. So I have to use the OHE-approved colors, and so they're fixing it for me. So you're going to see unapproved colors in the PowerPoint. We have shared the results with Minscu, and so we have heard some feedback from them. But so this is our kind of first-year results report. The first year of the part-time pilot, and just a reminder, the part-time pilot essentially in that straight grant model changed the slope of the family line based on the enrollment of the student. So if they were only enrolled for 3 credits instead of 15, it reduced it by from 100% down to 20% of the contribution was required. And so we wanted to measure the impact of that change. So the first thing we looked at is how many students who applied for a state grant were actually eligible for the change. It ended up being only about 24% of state grant applicants would have been eligible because they would have had to have been enrolled part-time, so 3 to 14 credits in a given term. They would have to have attended a Minscu institution, and they would have to have had a family contribution. So your lowest income students, those with a zero AFR, were excluded from the increase. In total, we had 27,510 recipients. 20,000 of those attended a state college. The remaining 7,000 attended a state university. The total award came in within expectations. I believe our cost estimate was $12 million per year. It came in at $11.8 million, of which approximately $9 million went to state college students and $3 million went to state university students.
Excuse me, Ms. Fergus. That strikes me as surprised that your forecast came in so close, but when we look at the other amount that is excess currently in the state grant program, that the take up, you know, wasn't near that much. So it seems like this was a group that really took advantage of this opportunity?
Madam Chair, I can't say for sure, but you were correct. The difference in the cost estimates for this change as opposed to the general fiscal year 14 change, there were different sizes, yes. This is simply a distribution of where those students went by state college or state university by income. And so you can see the cumulative percent of recipients. What we're showing here is that the largest number of recipients were in that middle range, about $20,000 to $60,000 in income. But there are some nuances to it that we'll explore in a few slides. In terms of distribution of dollars, what you see in this chart is that your lowest income students were excluded. If they did receive funds at that lower income level, they were more likely to be single without children and over age 24. So your single independent students without children. Those are going to be the ones that had in the lower income categories. Dependent students, as well as students from families who are independent with children, are likely to be at your upper income levels. This is the average increase from the part-time pilot by income level, by system. So the state colleges and the state universities. Of course, those increases would vary by the enrollment of the student. So students who enrolled in fewer credits might have seen a larger change as compared to students who enrolled in more credits on the end of the part-time spectrum. This slide shows you how it compares to the overall funding for students in the two sectors and in the three family types. What you can see in orange is the Pell Grant amount the student would have received, which does vary by enrollment. You have the state grant amount on top of that, and then finally the part-time increase, just to put them in perspective. So that kind of ends the overall just descriptives of where the funds were spent. What we would like to talk about is a couple of key findings. In terms of the part-time pilot, approximately 49% of funds went to students who were enrolled for 12 to 14 credits. So they were actually one class shy of the full-time level. If I'm remembering correctly, this wasn't the group that was really the target of the program. We were looking more at students who were taking 1 to 2 classes and trying to balance full-time employment or 3/4 time employment. Half your funds went to students taking 12 to 14 credits. In terms of family type, approximately half of the funds did go to dependent students, those who were 18 to 24. The remaining 54% went to students who were independent without children, 42%, and then only 12% of funds went to independent students with children. And there are, just so we're clear, there are very few of those students enrolled in college, period, to independent students with children. So it's not that they got less or received less. It's proportional to enrollment. We also examined changes in enrollment. So we looked at fall term credit levels for students in fall 2012 as compared to the first semester of the pilot fall 2013. There were no meaningful changes in enrollment. It's not that we didn't find differences. It's just that those differences were actually found across the populations, and so we can't say that it's a change due to the part-time pilot at this time. Generally, on average, dependent students took fewer credits. The average between the 2 years decreased by 0.4 credits, and that was across all institutions. Part-time pilot recipients had fewer average fall term credits at 0.8 decline, but that is so close to the 0.4 that we don't believe it's a meaningful change. It was likely more the economy rebounding than it was the part-time pilot specifically, resulting in decreased enrollment.
Senator Pratt? Excuse me.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Fergus. Quick question. How would students have found out about this program in such a way that we would have seen meaningful change?
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and Senator Rutt, that is a great question. I'm not exactly sure how they would have found out about it. I do know that both student associations talked about the change as a win for them, so it would have gone out through student leadership. In terms of financial aid, all they had on their financial aid letter was one line that said state grant. So unless they saw their grant in the previous year and this year change, they wouldn't likely have known about it, nor would they likely have known that this was the reason, one of the reasons why. Because remember, we actually changed 5 things in the state grant that year. This was only one of them.
Senator Pratt.
And so fair to say that they wouldn't have known about it in order to change their behavior before receiving their letter, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, correct.
Okay.
Unless there was some rumor that we didn't get held on. Madam Chair, independent students enrollment changes were mixed, and so generally we can't conclude anything for that group. Some of the students had increases, some had declines, depending on what sector they were at and what type, if they had children or no children. So again, no meaningful change in enrollment. The one thing we did look at is for the targeted populations that were discussed during the part-time pilot discussions 2 years ago, we did note that the one key group, low-wage working adults, was of interest to you. And what we did note is that they received portions of the part-time pilot funds, but in the scheme of the entire $12 million, they did receive less than half of those funds. So if that is a group that is the intended target, we could work to find ways we could target them specifically as opposed to the broad brush that the part-time pilot kind of advocated for. There is another group that we talked a lot about 2 years ago, but they were not helped by the part-time pilot, and those are dependent students without family financial support. So either their assigned family responsibility was zero, and therefore the change did netted them nothing. And so those were not awarded under the part-time pilot. And again, there was no meaningful change in enrollment. So I think the question is that we're left with is, of the $12 million, are there other ways we can target it to the intended groups?
And Ms. Fergus, do you, after seeing these results, did you make recommendations that influenced the governor's approach to how he did the state grant program, or commissioner? What's the connection between the way the governor's recommendation came out in terms of that and these findings?
The answer is yes. With scarce resources, I think the governor believes we should target them as best we can to help those most in need.
So just on that point, we have said as a committee that our three objectives are to increase completion rates, lower student debt, and better equip a 21st century workforce. So I do appreciate the governor's budget. I haven't said that publicly. Commissioner, I appreciate the focus on the University of Minnesota Med School. Appreciate that the governor continues to speak about the importance of higher ed. I would also say that if we look at kind of the percentages of where the additional resources went, it's my belief that higher ed is more important than ever, and so proportionally, and that I would like to see us always look at our dollars somehow connected to those goals of reducing student debt, which the state grant commitment does, so I really appreciate that, but I don't see any emphasis around student completion. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go back to page 26 and just review that again in terms of what exactly is this telling us?
Madam Chair and Senator, this is the average increase from the part-time pilot. So by income levels across the bottom, this is what the average student in that income at either a state college or a state university would have seen had they received a part-time pilot increase. So just those who received it, what their average increase was.
Senator Klassen.
Okay. Thank you. Just see if I'm correct then. If your adjusted gross income was $80,000 or more, and you attended a state university, you're getting $505. If your adjusted family gross income was less than $10,000, you're getting $268, or rather $240 if you're at a state university.
Madam Chair and Senator, that is correct, but keep in mind that these would have varied by enrollment level, so it could be that there are more part-time students in one of those two categories, which would have influenced the ultimate increase. Typically what we saw is that for students at the lower credit levels and the lower incomes, they got small increases, and they maxed out at upper incomes. Middle credit levels were the highest increase. At about $70,000, though, they start to taper off for dependent, independent, without children. That tapering occurs earlier if they're independent without children.
Senator Klassen.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still puzzled. I'm not puzzled. I'm just concerned about this a little bit because the people that can afford to pay and can afford to go full time are getting larger amounts than those that cannot be served by the project because of their income levels.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator.
Ms. Fergus.
It is also proportional to their assigned family responsibility. So essentially, if they had an assigned family responsibility of $5,000 and they were enrolled half-time, we essentially decreased that responsibility by $2,500. If they had a $500 family responsibility, which is a much lower income threshold, at the same enrollment level, we reduced that responsibility by $250. So that's going to create a definite difference in the increase they saw through the part-time pilot.
Can I ask another question, Senator? You're asking for everyone.
Am I? Well, I guess what it comes down to, you know, are we assisting those that can afford to do it? And are we not assisting those that are less fortunate and cannot do it as far as paying for a college education? I know there's a lot of factors that go into that, but when you look at this chart, that's the perception that you have.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Klausing. First, we should say that every student who got an increase benefited from it in some way. So it's not like the money was thrown into the ocean. I think the issue is, and I think the judgment the governor has made, is that $12 million a year or $24 million over 2 years could be better targeted, and that's what's in his proposal. The independent students.
Senator Nelson, did you have something?
I did. Madam Chair and Commissioner Pogemiller, I wasn't on this committee last year.
Right.
And so I've been trying to get myself caught up on what this one-time pilot project was as I've listened to the discussion here. But I just need a bit of clarification here. Are we actually incenting students to go part-time instead of full-time? I mean, that's kind of how I'm reading this chart. And I'm thinking
Senator
I must be missing
Nelson,
something.
You're taking his playbook from...
Well, we would not do that, would we?
So Senator Nelson, just so you have the facts, MNSCU students had as their number one priority that in coming through the recession, many of them really did need to work and only go part-time. And so they weren't having success at completion because they didn't get enough help for even the part-time they went because we don't prorate our state grants if, you know, you significantly fall off if you're not full-time. Thanks. And so we said, okay, and we felt pretty strongly as a committee. You can see the nods we took. You know, the commissioner was not in favor of that, nor was the governor, and perhaps nor was Senator Sheeran.
The sole vote.
Right, exactly. So you might have sided with Senator Sheeran. But we said, let's try it. You know, we hear you. Let's try it. We do want to support you to be able to go as much as you can. And will that help your completion rate? So Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, maybe a better way to look at it is what we were looking at trying to do was to incent people to go part-time rather than not go at all, which we were concerned about people not going to college because it was too difficult because they had work and family to support as well.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So we're in a different era now, perhaps, regarding the economy. So I guess this is something to really... I guess it's a good thing it was a pilot.
Yep, it was a pilot. Senator Sheeran.
You know, I think that your comment, Senator Eakin, is an important one, that we want to incentivize people to go part-time rather than to not go at all. I think that's really correct. But I have to go back at some other time to take a look at what I heard you communicate, that that there are some students who are of limited means who really are experiencing free college. Is that what I heard you say? So I mean,
tuition and fees.
Tuition and fees.
But living expenses roughly is half of it typically. So I mean that
we want to increase that living and maintenance. Oh, and now, is that available? Could we, if we wanted to modify this to address the issues that I think the committee really were trying to pay attention to, and I think there was merit in the pilot, so I don't want to. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be confusing in my messages about that. But is there what I think we can talk about is whether or not I think LME is a way to accomplish a lot of things, and so there are students that have almost free tuition or free tuition that are at the end where it's really difficult from an income perspective to get an education. And if we do meet their needs,
they might work less and study more.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you, Senator Pratt, and then Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Senator Claussen's line of questioning and Ms. Ferguson's explanation, you know, I look at this and looking at $70,000-$80,000 incomes today in Minnesota are not really high incomes. These are middle-income people. And what, based on the explanation I heard, is that maybe we found an area where the rising tuition costs for middle or slightly upper middle income families is starting to get out of reach. And so it kind of goes back to the concept where we've been trying to buy down tuition 2 years at a time, or at least hold it flat. And yet, you know, I think we saw last biennium fees and housing increased. And so the total cost of the students still went up. There's really no The cost of post-secondary education continues to rise kind of unchecked.
Yeah.
And this just really highlights to me the fact that we can try to help the low-income people, but we're really making higher education unaffordable for the average Minnesotan. And, I guess kind of looking for confirmation, yay or nay, or why am I wrong?
Commissioner?
Well, I think that is what is going on because people are taking on higher debt. Although we have seen in the last year or two, because some of the work you've done, the actual debt levels are going down slightly. At least we've stopped the increases. It's a challenging question. If I could step out, I'm now speaking for myself as I don't want to say that this is what the governor thinks. I think the legislature and the governor need to have a recognition that they don't control the pricing here. And no matter how much you put in financial aid, you're not controlling the pricing. The price is controlled by what institutions believe people will pay for whatever they're doing. And let me just take the medical school as an example. Third highest in the country. I believe they have 9,000 people who try to get in there every year for 400 slots. So is it too expensive? Is it not too expensive? I think it's a complex matter about judgments people are making about what they're willing to pay for. And, again, speaking for myself, I think that to some extent policymakers are limited. If you can figure out a way to help institutions contain costs, more power to you. But in the end, there are separate boards of trustees and presidents and chancellors that's their job to try to do that. And what you're left with, again, speaking for myself, is trying to protect lower income people from the market as best you can.
Well, Commissioner, I would also echo what Senator Pratt said, that it's not just the low income, that I think one of the most overlooked consequences of this last recession is that the middle income, and not even just like middle, but as the creeping up into the upper middle, those families have stopped helping their kids pay for college, and the ballooning of debt because their own retirement accounts, you know, went south because somebody lost their job. And so the ballooning of debt across all income levels is really problematic. And so that's what we're going to also be looking at when we look at what's the best way to use the state grant to help the most amount of kids, and of course targeted. But as you said, the really low income with our state grant program, they actually have it paid for. So particularly at Minsku. So all those things are things we should wrestle with.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add one other thing, because I'm sure I'm going to get emails on this. going into, like, I think the university's number, University of Minnesota, is $27,000 for a baccalaureate. If you make $27,000 or $30,000 coming out of the U of M, I think you would view that as a pretty good investment. At the non-public colleges, the number is actually lower across non-publics. And obviously at a two-year college, that debt number is significantly lower. And we need to be careful. There are absolutely people that have taken out $40,000 for a baccalaureate. Absolutely. But to some extent, some of that is outlierish. Or someone who, there was an article of a and I know I'm going to get an email on this, a veterinary student that was at 100, and it was a big number, 130,000 or 100, no, it was like 200,000. It was a lot of money. That's not the typical experience. The University of Minnesota, it's about 27,000 for a baccalaureate.
Well, we do know the average debt is 30,000 for undergrads right now in Minnesota, and I do hear the average debt for graduate students is astronomical.
That's where the bigger numbers are, graduate education. Yeah. And there's no, as we know, there's no financial aid in graduate education.
That's what it is.
Senator Sharon.
And I can't, I'm digging through here trying to find, but you also showed us a chart that when you're probably talking about living and maintenance expenses, about what we provide for, what the poverty level is, and then what the actual expenditures of students are. And that, I think, is an important document, because if we're trying to chase down the debts that students are creating for themselves, is if they are all...
Page 17, Senator Sharon, if you want to look at the chart.
I think that shows us that we have to choose that middle number to try to work with, because students are making other decisions about the debt they're taking out or the level of living that they're at or the various resources they're giving themselves and assets while they're in education that can have a large variation, and it's not really related to the paying for education itself, correct?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner.
I think that is very perceptive. The issue is not so much tuition fees as it is the trade-off between working and studying, the living expenses. That's a general statement. That doesn't mean there aren't some institutions where tuition fees is the issue. I'm just saying, when you look at the overall picture, it's really the living expenses and that trade-off between working full-time versus going to school.
And then the other is, what are you paying for with the debt that you're taking out? Is it all spending that you need to spend in order to get an education? That's what I think that graph shows us.
And Madam Chair, that's where it gets a little dicey. That's why on the LME, if we tie it to the poverty level, you're not going to get too many arguments about,
right,
well, the kid has an SUV.
That's right. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yes. But I think we still need to recognize that tying it to the poverty level, even though that is a level that we probably can justify, it's probably not totally reflective of that trade-off between work and study. And that's why I think Ms. Fergus was showing the consumer expenditure survey number.
And may I just say one more thing? I would be interested, because you started to talk, I think, about what I am trying to grapple with, and that is what, in fact, can we influence here? If you're saying that the market is driving the cost of education and we're just trying to make it possible for people to have access to that, because, you know, I am always trying to control the cost of education at some level or another, and the in the Minsky system, certainly we have more influence than we do at the University of Minnesota. When they put up for us, you know this, the where their sources of revenue are, I mean, we are a minor player in the deal, in the overall deal for the responsibilities that they carry out at the university. And yet we're trying to control the overall cost of education. So where can we have an influence over what we're talking about here? Not just how much it costs, how much we can give relief to students in paying that cost, but how we can really have an influence on what we're doing in our educational systems, what we're driving in terms of the cost of that education. The people need to earn a decent living.
And so, Commissioner, I'm just cognizant of time, and Senator Torres Ray has one, too. So these are important questions, and as we grapple with how we're going to handle our state grant for the coming year, we will have more discussion. But if you would respond,
well, just briefly,
please.
Madam Chair, your first choice, you select or have a hand in selecting regents and trustees, and their job is that job. I would argue, again, I'm speaking for myself, I think it's the access question to the best fits institution that you can have an impact on, and I believe some incentives or some funding around retention and completion is where you can have the most impact. And I would argue the retention completion issue is really, by and large, Minsky, because it's an open enrollment institution, and they in some respects get the most challenging task. University of Minnesota, although they've done wonderful increasing their retention completion, they've done wonderful, but part of that has been they've raised entrance requirements. So all institutions, private colleges, university, have been doing work on retention completion. The biggest task, though, is for Minsky because they are open enrollment. They are the total access for every Minnesota child. And so that's... And we just put out a report on this retention completion. I think it came to your desk today. But that's where I would argue, public policy-wise, you could have the most impact, and that generally means getting myself in trouble with everybody but Minsky. That generally means a significant investment at Minsky to help them help those students.
Senator Sheeran, I was reminded that they are back on Tuesday, so if we go over, we still have more time. So if you... You're welcome to take the time you need. I don't need you to be quiet. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, as I hear you and hear the members talk about what is that we need to do to make an investment that sustain our system over time, I can't help but to think that the enrollment decline is not unique to Minnesota. This is a national trend. So we talk about reciprocity and how do we calculate? Well, everybody around us has a decline, so we have a decline. So when we control here, if Wisconsin has a decline, how do we go about redrawing our formula on reciprocity? So to me, I think what will be very helpful is if the governor helps us understand what millennials and their parents are looking for. We are not getting what we need back for the investment that we make. I'm going to give you examples of what millennials talk about, what they can learn online for free. And meeting a requirement to take a class that costs $400 or $500 at the university and they could go online and learn for free. So millennials are very smart people who are saying, well, if I'm going to graduate after my parents pay $40,000, $50,000, and I'm going to get a job that only pays $25,000, why am I paying $50,000? My own kids are saying, why don't you give me the $50,000 and I put a business? So that argument is a very important argument for millennials. They are saying, don't pay that money. I'm going to learn something online, and I'm going to make that money. Don't do that. So this is a very, very important message. No, it doesn't really matter how we calculate, how we redraw our formulas to pay here, and who this pilot, to me, is an example. I am not so sure that we understand what happened with this pilot because you had a decline anyway. So you didn't get what you get with what you wanted with the pilot. Well, there are other measures around it that probably influence this outcome. So I think that I would like to see your administration, the governor, helping us understand how is that the Minsky system and the university are actually helping us help our families and our students obtain degrees that we can afford to get the jobs that they need to get in order to make a decent living. And I think that is where we can be we can transform the way we do higher education. It is not by looking at formulas of how do we pay to compensate the parts that families cannot compensate because they are poor or whatever is the formula that we are trying to do, in my opinion. So I want to hear your thoughts as to, are we moving in that direction of calculating this generation, which is a completely different thing. Kids are even moving outside of the country, not just outside of Minnesota, because it's cheaper to get undergraduate degrees outside of the U.S.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, save me on this one. Maybe we should talk about the committee's metrics report now, because it kind of gets at some of that.
We can do that, and I think you raise important questions, and we will continue to talk about it. But I hear what you have asked for is the governor responding to the demand for innovation in the delivery of higher ed, and how does his budget respond to that?
Right. I just don't think that without that conversation you can put enough money. The decline in enrollment is so real. And it's just big, and we need to know why. Why is that kids are not enrolling
in
higher ed?
And by the way, Minsky experienced a decline. The University of Minnesota has not experienced that decline, although Duluth has. Duluth has experienced that decline.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make sure it may not have any, it likely has nothing to do with what Minsky is doing. It has to do with the economy,
right,
their increase and decrease. So I think separating those two issues is important. And I think the chair made the point, not all higher ed institutions are in having a decline. I mean, if you have controlled enrollment, which is everybody other than Minsky, because it's the only open enrollment institution, even the for-profits are no longer open enrollment. They control on the front end a little bit because of their federal requirements. But so I think keeping in mind the uniqueness of Minsky is really important, and supporting Minsky in a way where they can be successful with the most challenging cohort of students, I just think is one of the fundamental issues for Minnesota, because we cannot afford to leave any, whether you like or dislike the No Child Left Behind. Economically, we cannot afford to leave any student behind in post-secondary right now, because when the baby boomers retire, we're running out of people. And I think, although this exists at all the colleges, not just Minsky, it evidences itself most at Minsky because that's where most of the students are.
So we will challenge the administration and all of us to respond to the changing times and the need to deliver higher ed in the most innovative way possible. So thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and thank you, everybody, for this discussion. So we started our committee 10 minutes late because we always wait for a quorum, and so we get 10 minutes extra. If you guys want to end on time, got to come on time. So with that, Ms. Fergus, Ms. Fergus goes into this report, I want to remind committee members why we're hearing this. Because 2 years ago, we said that there has to be some way for us to make sure that if colleges aren't delivering on the promise, if they aren't graduating their students, if their students aren't getting jobs, then we shouldn't give them taxpayer dollars. They shouldn't be able to access the state grant. And so instead of us just making it up, and California, if you recall, looked at making some changes based on institutional metrics, and the Obama administration has been trying to go in this direction and actually got sued for not going about it in a scientific and data-driven enough way. So we didn't want to be in that situation. We asked the Office of Higher Ed to pull together people in the industry and to come back and make recommendations as to how we could put metrics in place that we would say, if you don't live within these, you don't have access to grant money. So that's the preamble, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. You pretty much summed up the background perfectly. So we came to you a year ago and asked for some direction on what the priorities and goals for this initiative were. And I think we agreed that what was critical for Minnesota was ensuring student access, affordability, and student success. Those were our guiding frameworks. So we actually convened a working group of institutional representatives, and of course, Mr. Kornecki was on the group as well, to kind of work through the institutional metrics, refine them, and figure out exactly what were we trying to measure in terms of institutional performance and the return to state dollars. So what you have before you, and I believe, members, you have a report in your packet called Using Data to Determine Institutional Participation in State Student Aid Programs. It's a lovely title. But this is our second report. The first report, of course, was last year. And what the report does is it lays out the framework, which you asked us to do. So in terms of metrics, we actually have refined our list down to 9 key areas of kind of measuring institutional performance. The first area, of course, is access. We want to measure how well the system is serving individuals, especially those individuals in need of upward economic mobility. So we're looking at key groups, lower-income students, students of color, and students over age 25. The working group actually recommended we also include rural Minnesota students in this, and we struggled with the methodology on that one, so it's kind of in our back pocket. It may appear in a refined report. The second grouping is affordability, and those are the measures of educational costs in comparison to resources available to the student. So it's that financial access question. Are they able to afford their higher education? Specifically, we're looking at what is called net price, and that is the out-of-pocket cost to the students after all grants and scholarships are considered. So what do they have to either pay for with cash or student loans? We're also looking at cumulative debt. The one thing to keep in mind for affordability is that you have a lot of influence over what the net price is across institutions through the state grant program, and Congress has a lot of power over the Pell Grant program. If you change those two things, you can really influence net price across all institutions dramatically, more so than the institution. And so it's important that the affordability, the state-level context is considered and the system-level context is considered. The institutions only have minimal control based on where they set their cost of attendance. Not minimal, limited control. The state has a lot of influence, is the point.
Madam Chair, on net price, not on the list price.
Right. Yep.
Correct. Madam Chair, we believe it's the final category. Student success is where really the time is invested. These are measures of how well an institution is moving students through the educational pathway and also measures their post-enrollment outcomes to ascertain whether they're achieving that long-term financial sustainability. We don't want students to necessarily graduate from college. We want them to graduate, find employment at a wage where they can have a family and stay in Minnesota. So it's that long-term financial sustainability that really is the critical factor. So what we're looking at there is persistence. So we're looking at students moving across institutions but continuing their pathway through education. We're looking at new students. Are they still enrolled at 12-month intervals? So from their first enrollment, are they still there 12 months later, 24 months later, 36 months? And we use 12 months so that we can pick up students who start in fall as well as spring in a single metric. The second thing is we want to make sure they're making progress towards their program goal. So are they accumulating credits that add up to that associate degree or that bachelor's degree? Are they making progress over time? Completion is the same thing. Are they completing their program? And again, we'll look at 12-month intervals so we can pick up the short-term programs as well as longer-term programs. Typically, a bachelor's degree, we'd look at the 48 or the 60-month mark, 4 or 5 years. The final three metrics are going to be more your post-enrollment outcomes basis. The first thing we want to look at is, and this is possible thanks to the part in having that SLEDS data system, is we want to look at, for graduates who are employed in Minnesota, what percentage of them are employed year-round? Because we know that to obtain that long-term financial outcome, they really need to be employed year-round in all four quarters consistently, and likely they need to be employed full-time. So that's one of the alternative measures that's in the report. We also want to look at the wage premium. Is their degree yielding an increase in hourly wages that would kind of provide them with that positive outcome they need to see? So we're looking at wages after graduation compared to minimum wage standards. Ideally, we'd compare it to high school graduate wages, but we don't have high school graduate wages yet available to us. And the last one is, of course, return on investment. We want to compare the out-of-pocket cost students are paying for higher education as compared to that wage premium they're getting over time. So it's more of a ratio of costs in and benefits out to the individual student. So those are the metrics that what we've laid out in the report. What we've also laid out in the report is an implementation plan. The first step would be, of course, is to do the institutional performance reports and make sure in step two that we're validating that data with institutions. Many of the colleges have never had access to the graduate employment data, and so this is a new data source for them. But we want to make sure that the data we use in this initiative is the strongest possible data and that the institutions agree with us that it's the strongest possible data. We're going to go a little more in-depth into steps three and four in the next slides. Step three of the primary purpose is to identify which institutions are high or low performing. In our last report, we actually asked that you look at both. The low performers, of course, because we want to incent them to do better, but the high performers because we want to figure out what they're doing that is paying off and how can we scale that up statewide. So to do that, we're going to finish development of the metrics and benchmarks to ensure we have valid and reliable measures to prevent those legal challenges that the U.S. Department of Ed has had to deal with over the last 5 years that they've been doing this. You'll also need to determine what are the benchmarks for actual termination of eligibility and figuring out what is the minimum standard you expect institutions to achieve. Those do have to be research-based benchmarks. The other thing is we proposed 9 benchmarks for you, 6 of which fall into the student success category. Is there one benchmark we should really be relying on, or is it going to be a weighted use of multiple benchmarks? That is a question we leave to the committee. Also, improvement over time. You may have a low performer who is making progress, so you need to determine at what point do you want to terminate them from eligibility, or do you want to allow them to make progress as long as they meet a standard within a given time frame? And finally, this is one our group has struggled with enormously, is which institutions do you compare? And so there's a number of frameworks that we've kind of been working through. You would never compare Normandale to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. They serve different populations and have different missions. And so making sure that our institutional differentiation is clear on who we're comparing to who. Step four is talking about the kind of legislative action, the language changes that would be needed to implement this. The first is that statutory authority for OHE to actually move ahead in establishing the benchmarks. We would need to amend institutional eligibility language to reference the benchmarks. And this is a key thing. The initial mandate specified all state financial aid programs, so we'd need to specify whether you wanted to include self-loans, the GI Bill, work-study, child care, state grant, or just state grant, so making some differentiation there. We would also would like you to consider amending the language for institutional termination, which is proposed, I believe, by OHE this year. So you'll be seeing it shortly. So we'd need to add some additional language in there and set up a process for reinstating institutions after they achieve minimum standards. We would also ask that you consider to amend the language for institutional registration and licensure. We believe that it's not just important that you prevent state grant funds from flowing to institutions that are low performers, but those institutions would still be collecting tuition and fees from students. So if you truly feel a college has not met a minimum standard, we would ask that you consider not allowing them to operate in the state to truly protect the student. And finally, I don't even want to go into how many pages of administrative rules we would have to have about around this whole process. I'm glad I don't work in that division. But there is some clarity needed on probationary periods, appeal processes, whether the commissioner would have the waiver authority. There's a whole series of administrative steps. How long are institutions notified before the termination takes effect? Is it a 12-month period? Are current students terminated as well as new students? So there's a number of those administrative questions. And finally, we do include in the report some cautions. The one, I think our primary caution, which is really results from OHE's basis on financial aid, is that state grants go to students, not institutions. And so what you're really terminating is the student's ability to receive funds if they choose to attend a certain college. That is very different than terminating an institution. The second thing is our ability to isolate institutional performance on any of these metrics. We know, in fact, employment is largely influenced by the economy in general. So what extent is the institution the responsible party for having a low employment rate? The third thing is there's a lot of discussion on whether performance-based models actually work. So we're awaiting to see what Tennessee has done. They actually fund the majority of system appropriations through performance funding. There's a number of other things we're looking at there. And, of course, the possible overlap with other efforts. Institutions are already required to meet minimal standards to participate in both state and federal financial aid, so this would be an expansion. Also, there are minimum standards for licensing and registration to operate in the state of Minnesota. And, of course, the U.S. Department of Ed is still continuing forward on their post-secondary institution rating system. The good news there is most of the metrics we've chosen also appeared in their initiative, so apparently we're both on the same track. And they, too, are now identifying high performers as well as low performers. I might want to claim some plagiarism on that one.
How many years have they been working on it?
The U.S. Department of Ed has been working on this related initiatives in this area since 2009. So,
well, Ms. Fergus, thank you so much for your leadership and for this report. We did really await it with a great deal of interest, and I would encourage members to take the time to bring this report home and really dive into it, because we will have to decide what tack we want to take with regard to these.
Correct.
So thank you very much. Any questions? Well, there you have it. I guess we're ending on time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Committee's
adjourned. Chair.